My name is Lynn and I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
Thank you so much, Polly and Lee and the committee members, to set this up for us. How very fortunate. And Hillary, it's a tough act to follow. I could sing Alouette, gentille Alouette. But I don't think that I'm going to give you any goose flesh. Lee invited my husband to come along this weekend to help him out, and I see him holding the dog. So he's babysitting. Oh, gosh, I am so tremendously grateful. I'm aware that many of you are in recovery houses right now, and what a wonderful place to be. That's where I started my sobriety for 10 months, and it's such an opportunity to be able to put aside life and to just concentrate on building our program. And they gave us to read that wonderful big book. It is by far the most important book I've ever read. And if you are new, you want to start at the first preface, right at the beginning. I have some sponsees in Switzerland who started a workshop there, and I heard that they did not want to start to read the big book until page one, because the doctor's opinion, the guy is not an alcoholic. What does he know? This is so alcoholic. And so and it's wonderful to read it at home, but I also recommend that you read it with your sponsor, that you read it with others. This is our program of recovery. This is our textbook. The 12 steps are lined out in the big book from number 1 to number 12. Doing it alone is too difficult. The words are difficult. The concepts are difficult. But we read it together, and then we have a chance to take the steps and have wonderful recovery. I'm an alcoholic, just like the type that was described so beautifully by my wonderful friend Tammy, that we get to share that this weekend. She was invited to be a host and saw the list of the speakers and said, "Oh, I know Lynn." And so Polly said, "Well, why don't you host her then?" So it's another little miracle, one of those coincidences in our program. And last night, I fell asleep early, and the doorbell rings, and I thought it was my husband coming back. So I opened the door. "Oh, bonjour, mon chéri. Susan!" She surprised me. She'd sent me a couple of texts about how she would have loved to have come but couldn't come. And so from Oregon, and she came a day early to make sure she would be on time for the meeting tonight. And we'll spend some time this weekend. So thank you so much for the lovely surprise. You know, I'm one of those real alcoholics, and I love the effect of drinking. For a long time, it was my solution to all my shyness and insecurities that I've had since I was a child. I was afraid of the dark, afraid of the little girls, afraid of my parents. I was just afraid, and I had pretty much my eyes into my shoes, in a corner, knowing that nobody liked me and not knowing what to say. When I was 13, we went to a little party, and I bought 6 beers. I have no idea why I bought 6 of them, not even knowing what that would do for me. And before I was halfway through that first beer, all my fears went away. And it was comfortable in my gut where I lived. I could be jolly with the little girls. I could not care what they thought of me. I was right in the middle of the pack. I blacked out. I went to get my last beer, and they told me my best friend Susan drank my beer. I found her, and I slapped her in the face. yeah, this is not social drinking. And I continued to drink for 14 more years. And I had no power over my drinking. I know some of you were social drinkers for a while. I was an alcoholic, overshooting the mark from the very beginning. Once I began to drink, I cannot stop. I never could. I would have liked to have been able to have 5 or 6, but I could never have 1 or 2 drinks. It doesn't matter the price that I had to pay. This was beyond my power. If you are new, this really is an illness. It's not that we lack ambition, that we're lazy, that we're not intelligent, that we lack willpower in any other areas. It's just as far as alcohol is concerned, I was powerless. And if you are an alcoholic like me, you're doomed like I was. And I'm so glad that you're here tonight, because there is hope here. There is hope. I continued to drink whenever I could, and I remember maybe a year or two later going to this little party at the community center with this boy, Robert. And I remember dancing, and the next thing I knew, Robert was tapping me on the shoulder. I was downstairs on the floor, and they put either a coat or a blanket over me. And so he took me home. And maybe a year or two later, I went to a Christmas party. Everybody else was an adult. And I went with Robert. And I remember sitting on the couch. It was going to be an exchange of gifts and dinner. And they brought me a drink. It was amber in color. And I started to drink, and I was thinking, I hope they have a lot of those. I don't know where that comes from. Next thing I remember, Robert is touching me on the shoulder. I was in a bedroom in the back with a blanket over me. I missed the whole thing. I was so confused with this. And I never went to my parents and said, you know what, Mom, I had this one drink, and I have no idea what happened after that. I just kept those thoughts. And shortly thereafter, there was another party, and there were a bunch of us going with cars. And I remember in the trunk of that car, they had put all the cases of beers. And I'm thinking, I have to go sit in that car. Now, I didn't know anything about alcoholism, about what was going on with me, but somehow I knew this was different. And I never talked about it, and I was ashamed of the way that I drank. It seemed like the others were not like that. And I thought, well, if only I had a good education, I could be happy. This is going to fix it. And when I was 24 years old, I had a license to practice law. So I was smart, I studied hard, but you know, I drank more. And this was in Quebec, Canada, so I thought, well, I'm going to go to California. And I did, and I just drank more. And then I found myself a boyfriend, and I thought this would fix it, but we drank together. And he proceeded to acquire all the things, and I just drank more. And finally, I thought, I know, I need a cleaning lady. Well, love cleaning ladies. And I supervised her work with a drink in my hand, you see. My outside circumstances are totally irrelevant. I drink because I'm an alcoholic, and when I start, I cannot stop. And in my case, it was very progressive. Each time, it just seemed to get worse, regardless. And so I'm not sure why that boyfriend broke up with me, except one time I slept with his best friend, Kurt. Now, It was not really my fault. See? And I didn't like him. But I was in a bar, and I was too drunk to make my way home, and he was the guy next to me. Qualified him. And you know, it talks about in our big book how the horrible shame or consequences of our drinking of a few weeks or a few months ago cannot be brought forth with enough force to stop us from doing what we're doing. And Nothing in my mind came like, Lynn, this is your boyfriend's best friend. Your boyfriend, you're living in his house. He's supporting you. You are an illegal alien. You are emotionally, I mean, almost. you have no money. You're estranged from your family. The only people who are tolerating you are his friend. To go sleep with the guy just isn't a good idea. This does not come to mind. I said, okay. And the next morning, his girlfriend found us, and she was my boyfriend's secretary. That's kind of tacky, but she, so I got a phone call 3 days later that all my stuff had been put in trash bags and to come and pick that up. I was totally humiliated and so afraid to go to that office in case she would be there, he would be there. So I did, and I picked up the trash bags, and I rented a room in a two-bedroom apartment. I put my clothes on the floor. I was sleeping in a sleeping bag on the floor, and I lived like an animal. And I had lost such respect and self-worth and self-esteem. I had so little idea on how to take care of myself, how to be responsible, that the only answer I had was I have to go back into that house. And I had learned how to reseal Mexican tiles with my law degree and everything. And so I called him up and I said, I'll do your tiles for free. So he accepted. And the next morning I showed up at the house with the grubbies and the chemicals and the knee pad, and I knocked on the door, good morning. I got on my knees and I started to scrub. He left for work and I got drunk, and when he came home, he asked me to leave his house. And that night I was so ashamed of the way that I lived. My life had become so unmanageable that I did not want to go to that little apartment in case the roommate would be there. So I slept in my car after drinking enough vodka. And when I came to in the morning, I drank more of that vodka. And I went back to the house, and good morning, and I got on my knees, and I started to scrub, but he was not going to the office. They were having a party that day, and they were going to play tennis in the backyard. And so the friends who had invited me into their homes, the friends I had invited into that house for my special fancy dinners, did not want to have anything to do with me. And they just passed by and said, hi, Lynn. And here comes Kirk. Hi, Lynn. I wanted to dig a hole when they talk about demoralization. I was so humiliated. I just kept my head down. And finally they left in the afternoon, and I found myself alone with that man who had loved me, who had wanted to marry me. And he was on top of me doing what he had to do, trying not to touch me. And I will never forget the look of utter disgust and contempt in that man's eyes looking down at me. And I left his home that afternoon because he asked me to. And I went back to that apartment and I binged all weekend. But what happened was, no matter how much I drank, I could not get drunk. I was sober from the neck up. It's the worst place. I was unable to achieve any kind of relief from my pitiful condition. And on Monday morning, after trying to drink some vodka to calm my nerves, I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And the man said, oh, you want to stop drinking? I said, no. I want to learn how to have 5 or 6. It's after that I get in all this trouble. And he said, you're not ready for us. When you want to stop drinking, you call us back. And he hung up on me. Well, if you knew, the day that Alcoholics Anonymous hangs up on you is a bad day. We really are the last house on the block. This is it. So if you are in a recovery house, my goodness, I pray that you may find the courage, the humility, the tenacity to just stay for as long as they tell you you need to stay before throw yourself back out there. You'll be back there soon enough. It's not so easy to learn to live, to pick ourselves literally from a floor, to stand up, to learn to be a lady. It is not so easy. But there's a lot in that room, heroes who have been my teachers and my examples who've been able to do it, and you're next in line, so you come with us and together we're going to get there. He hung up, so a couple of hours later I called back. What happened was, into my innermost self, I admitted that I was powerless. What I heard was, Lynn, you're done with drinking. There is nothing left in this for you. And I called back and he said, oh, great, a lady in your area will call you. And she did, and she said, would you like to go somewhere? And I said, oh, yes, I'm a traveler. I love going places. And I thought they would take me to the La Costa Resort. I could use the massages, the mud bath. I was tired. And I would send a bill to my ex, no problem. So I eagerly accepted the proposition. I packed a few clothes, and she and her husband took me to detox downtown. I was disappointed, but I stayed, and the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous began for me that day, June 21st, 1982. And I'm still sober today, so. Thank you. I thank you for my sobriety date. And so they gave me the 20 questions, and I thought, well, I've taken tests that were much more difficult than this. And indeed, I got 17 right the first time I took it. So he said, you're an alcoholic. I said, I know. He said, no kidding. You really are an alcoholic. I said, I know. So what is so funny or happy about this? And I said, well, finally someone is telling me what is wrong with me. I had thought myself a lot worse things than being an alcoholic because of the promiscuity. And he was telling me that I was sick, like Tammy read about tonight. This allergy with the obsession of the mind, and that I was doomed, and that there were many others just like me, and that there was a solution. And I could be sober and happy. This was the best news I had heard in a long, long time. In the doctor's opinion, I love the last word. Now, nobody told me that. This is my own original idea. Believe me, I have one. And you know, after the meeting, someone would tell me, oh, no, then I heard that speaker one day, and they said that. The very last word in the doctor's opinion is pray. Isn't that cool? That's a doctor. He knew he was powerless to help us, that medicine couldn't help us, that we were to pray. And then, of course, we have this wonderful second step, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity, not to maturity. I'm still waiting. And you know, I have, just to be current with you, we just moved into this beautiful home in a few months ago, and we had to replace the front tree. So we went and bought a beautiful tree, and when they came to deliver it, it was not the one that we picked. And they had broken some branches, and we returned it. So we went back, we picked another tree. They came to deliver it, and we're thinking, this is not going to go. We didn't see the back of that tree. This will not work. But we felt bad about sending it again, so we watched it being planted. And then I said, honey, this is not going to work, you know. And so we took some strap to put the branches down, and the neighbor comes over, and instead of saying, oh, what a beautiful tree, he said,
what happened?
So I said, honey, we can't have a what happened in front of the house. And I'm having a problem with this. Like, what will everybody say? And then you see it from the front door to the window. And of course, I'm passing by the hallway in the house and I'm looking for the trees. Oh, that's terrible. And so in the evening, it's like midnight, and I'm talking to Werner about the tree still. And then it's 3:00 in the morning, and I wake up because of the tree. Said, you know, but by now it's our fault. So I'm just going to go and tell the man my feelings. I'm not going to ask for anything. I mean, I was almost crying. And they agreed to come and give us another tree. And you know, my husband is a known alcoholic, and those things happen, and he just kind of looks at me. Because he can surf the waves, you know, and I dive in and come back up, and I'm the one working the program and sponsors and Skyping for 2 hours and all the service and the steps, and I'm still diving. If I don't get what I want, we are beaten down to a level of reasonableness. I love that word. I'm still searching for reasonableness, you know. I'm good to go. Better be what I want. Now, we have this beautiful view over the lake and the mountains. From the kitchen, from the living room, the meditation room, it's lovely. 100% beautiful view. Except here down in the corner, it's a private road with a small, it's not even a cul-de-sac, just an area to turn, and the neighbors parks there, that one neighbor. That's all I see. So when we bought the tree, we bought two smaller ones to hide the cars there, but they end up being too small. The problem is still not fixed. And so I talked to the other neighbors because I need allies, right? They don't like the neighbors being parked there either. And so he's an attorney, and he's looking into the easement document. Meanwhile, I go to the fire marshal at the fire department to see who is in charge and what would happen. And then I thought, you know, people will not realize how serious this is today. So I measured it. It's 40 feet by 60 feet. This is 3 weeks ago. So finally, I call my sponsor. She said, you don't write, do you? I said, no, no. She said, well, maybe you need to write about this. This is like a resentment. I said, oh, all right. After all these years, all this work, you would think I could catch it. This is a resentment. This is why I still need a sponsor today. I call her once a week so we connect so she can check me out. And so I wrote my resentment and I call her, and it's defiance, control, applying my values to other people. I mean, she said, you're going to have to pray for him. I said, yes, I'm going to pray he wins the lottery so he can go buy a house somewhere else, you know? She said, no, no, you're going to pray that they learn to respect their neighbors. I was saying the prayer an hour and a half ago, you know, hurry up, God. So this is the little neighbor situation. My mind is different than other people. We went hiking 2-3 months ago, and we're on top of that little mountain in Las Vegas. And coming back, it's sort of treacherous. And Werner is an alpine guide. I mean, he's done this stuff. We're coming down, and then we get lost a little bit. And then we stop, and now I'm thinking on the side of the mountain. Now I'm thinking Mount Everest. It's 3 o'clock. It's going to get dark. Am I going to have to sleep here? Oh, my goodness, this is not comfortable. Meanwhile, there are two other people who are lost behind. So Werner said, I found it, but wait, Lynn. I'm going to go get these two other people. They are afraid. I said, no, I'm going down. I'm hungry. And he's getting upset. He said, no, Lynn, we have to take care of those two other people. And I started marching down with my head telling me, Lynn, this is a professional alpine guide. You follow. Nobody's going to tell me what to do. All the way down the mountain. It was a very quiet ride back to the hotel. So a week later, I'm still not catching on. I'm talking to a sponsee who's telling me about a situation with her boyfriend, and I said, well, it sounds like you owe him and a man. She said, yes, I guess you're right, blah, blah, blah. And so later on, I'm telling her about the mountain. She said, Lynn, you owe him and a man. She said, Lynn, he had to feel so bad about this because he could not be responsible for all his people. Oh, yeah. So he comes home. I said, honey, I'm so sorry. I realized that you just wanted to be responsible, taking care of everybody. Exactly, honey. You're so adorable. Thank you for saying that. So I need a sponsor. I need sponsees. I need to come to meet. You can tell you all going like this, you know. Yes, yes. This is a lot of hope for the newcomers, you know? Oh, my goodness. And it tells us also that our defense against the first string must come from a higher power. The alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first ring. So we have to come to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us. For me, it was very gradual. At a recovery house, the ladies, they would write about God, and I would grab some ideas that I felt comfortable with, and I saw that they were sober, and sober longer than me, and I believe in the steps, I believe in the program, I believe what you were talking about. And today, I am still coming to believe that one day, if the tree does not suit me, I'll say, no big deal. I am still seeking to be returned to sanity under all circumstances. I was sober maybe 25 years or so, and my little dog died, and I had never experienced grief before. I can tell you, I woke up with it. I went to bed with it. It was there all day. This went on for about 2 weeks, and I was speaking at a conference, I think in Oregon, and there were like 2,000 people in that building, and it had the feeling of a Super Bowl. There was such excitement, but I was kind of numb. I was surrounded by love. I attended 6, 7, 8 AA meetings that weekend. I was the Sunday morning speaker. I could not have been more in the midst of Alcoholics Anonymous, more current with my sponsors, sponsees, service, the steps, as safe as you could be. They took me back to the airport, and I found myself alone for the first time in 3 or 4 days, and the pain came back like anesthesia wearing off after surgery, and I got despondent. I thought, that pain will never leave. This is not worth living. And I got on that commuter plane. I felt claustrophobic anyway. I was really uncomfortable. And then the liquor cart came, stopped next to me, pouring a drink to the guy to my left. And the thought came, this would make it go away. even if just for a little while. And I started to salivate. And I saw myself, if I grab that bottle, she's going to have to give it to me. I could not go to a meeting, did not have my big book, could not go for a walk, call anybody. And I said, "Dear God, please take this away from me." And His grace descended upon me. It took about 5 or 6 minutes. So, not that I'm anything special, but you don't expect that the Sunday morning spiritual speaker got drunk on her way home. You know, you just... So, I am very cognizant that under the best circumstances, should a few conditions arise at the same time, I can find myself vulnerable to that first drink. And so, in the big book, the only odds that they talk about is rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed the path. And that if we fail to enlarge our spiritual life today in working with others, we may not be able to face the trials ahead. We hear of people who get drunk on the plane after being sober for a long time, but maybe not current in their program. So I'm telling you that I'm not taking any chances. And if you are new, this is such a wondrous life to live, but we do have this chronic and curable mortal disease that will kill us. We are powerless. Our lives are unmanageable. Come to believe that this power could restore us to develop that relationship with a higher power. And throughout the weekend, the speakers will come about all the steps, and I will be followed by someone who will do the third step, and we can talk about this more later. We need to ask ourselves but one short question: do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? In my case, it was very simple. It was just you. I believed you. I believed you. And I would see my roommate getting on her knees to pray at the recovery house. So how could she embarrass herself like this? So there is hope for all of us if we only keep seeking and keep coming to meetings and listening. I love this sentence here at the end of the second step in the big book. Some of us had already walked far over the bridge of reason toward the desired shore of faith. I just love that. Those of you who live in recovery houses who are here today with us, that is certainly walking toward the desired shore of faith. To be here with 200 or 300 women, not knowing what's going to happen to you, what will we be talking about, the insecurities, the comparison, and it's sad, you know, all the inner work that we do, how we give of ourselves to the world. And yes, we worry about the size of our waist. You know, maybe we're not as vain as I am. That's on my list. I was in Cairo 3-4 years ago, and I just felt so comfortable there with all these ladies very much covered from head to toe. And it's when we went back to the airport that I realized it's because I could not compare their figures with mine. And you know, now I'm 60, and I'm usually comparing myself with the teenagers, and I'm losing the end of that stick. And one more time, when I'm in my vanity, it's because I'm thinking about myself. What you think of me? I would always want more popularity, more admiration. I want to be liked so much, you know. But if I want to look at you and give you a compliment if I think you have beautiful eyes, it no longer matters to me, at least at the moment, what I look like. It is an inside journey. I have never felt so good about who I am, how I look, what I do in my life. I'm learning to be a wife right now, and I'm just loving this, just loving being a wife and retired. I mean, so many gifts that have occurred to me as a result of getting sober, doing that first, second step all the way through the 12th and living the sober life. Great event have come to pass. Polly says that, and I just love to hear it. About 5 years ago, I went on a safari, and I saw a little school that needed help, I felt. And so I started a charity, a foundation, and started to helping them out. And last year, we completed, Werner and I, to build a library for that school, and it's the only public school in Tanzania that has a library. And so that's what you've taught me to do, to look outward, to see what I can do to help. We talked about going towards the shore of faith, and I was being told how there were so many unfinished buildings in Africa, but hey, it's a God thing. Now, if I think it's a God thing, I feel the power of the universe is with me. And it doesn't mean that it's going to go smoothly, that it's going to be perfect, that mistakes are not going to be performed, but it means that God will see it through every time. About 3.5 years ago, I got a call from an ex-husband. By the way, I spent 2.5 years in Switzerland, and I went there with a husband, and I came back with another one. That's done. Oops. And it kind of messed up my schedule, so I came back early. And so with that first one, we got a call to go to Vevey, Switzerland, to work for this international company at their headquarters. And I was saying, it's going to take a three-bedroom apartment. And I was being told it's very expensive there. You'll never get a three-bedroom. And it's got to be a little yard for the dogs. Forget about getting a yard. It's going to be an apartment. And it's very, very rare to find something like that. And we need a doggy door. You're setting yourself up for a huge disappointment. But towards the shores of faith from the bridge of reason. And so got there, and then they told us it's going to take a long time for you from that furnished apartment to move into a house, but take your time, and it might take months, and it's stressful. And so the first morning that this realtor came to get me, she had a list of what was available according to our criterion, and they were all apartments, but there was one house. And in any case, I got goose flesh. I said, we're going to find that today. She said, no, we have months. No, we're going to find that today. And so we looked at the first three apartments, and it was like, I would never want to live there. And this was like above average price. So, oh my goodness, this is terrible. And I figured the house would be dilapidated. So we go to this neighborhood, lovely, that looked like where I lived in the States. And I get goose flesh, this is so comfortable, but the house are beautiful. So we make our way up to that little cul-de-sac, and there was a house there with an edge all around. All the yard was completely enclosed. We drove in, the renter came out, I said, is that completely safe for dogs? She said, yes it is. I said, that's the house. So I walk up the few stairs, and there was a doggy door there. From the bridge of reason towards the shores of faith. And then they told me, you probably won't be able to work. And if you do, that company, they try to hire the spouses, but it might take a year, if ever. So, after 2 months, I wanted to start to work. I sent my resume on a Monday. On a Wednesday, I get a call from the recruiter's secretary. She said, we have nothing for you. We just need to have a conference call on Friday with the recruiter. Okay, no problem. So I talked to him on Friday. That afternoon, I get an email from the manager of the legal department. We're looking for a U.S. paralegal. We just got approved. Can you have an interview with me on Monday? And she gave me the job. And so this has been my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. To just trust that we are so well taken care of. The safety net is like this underneath us, provided we keep ourselves safe in the middle of it. And I always check with my sponsor, always. And I listen to the few first words out of her mouth before I convince her that indeed it was a great idea. Always. And then while I was working for that company, I went to their HR and asked if they could help me with the charity. And they talked with me a little bit, and they interviewed me, and she said, you know, we really like your story. We would like to publish an article in our gazette that goes out to all the employees, and we'll put that in our Extraordinary Lives section. You know how extraordinary our lives are. You know. And I said, great. And so Werner, who's a retiree of that company, got the magazine at home. And send me an email. And I've done volunteer work in Africa, blah, blah, and I love what you're doing, and may I help you? And so 2 more weeks later, we had lunch, and I just fell off the ground. I just, oh my goodness, I love that man. And I'm just listening to his talk, and my heart is pounding, and I just want to be in his arms. This was in October. And the month before, I had told my other husband, I cannot even think of being your wife anymore. We'll get a divorce when we're back in the United States. It was a 6-year marriage, and I wanted a divorce for 5. And so we'll just continue our separate lives. And then a month later, I meet Werner. But I don't know his situation. And I had to sit on that for 2 months, you know, and there is no book written about situations like this, specifically, except the big book and those principles. And we have a principle of honesty that's on top of the list. And so while I'm in a foreign country, it sounds like it's a repeated history from Canada to the U.S., but I was sober at that time. I was employable. I had friends. I had a life. And I figure, okay, I've got to tell that first one, although I have a temporary job, temporary visa. And if Werner is not interested, I'll just take a plane back to the United States, get an apartment, get another job, and just go back to my life, and then go to conventions and go to AA meetings. And so, one more time, towards the shores of faith, that if I told the truth, God would be right there with me. So I told that first husband, I need a divorce now. I may be dating somebody. Clearing the neighborhood, just in case. And so, it turned out he was interested. And he came back here with me, and we're married, and it's the best thing that's ever happened to me after Alcoholics Anonymous and all of you. thank you. And when I got to Switzerland, and I don't want to spend much time on this because it is the 12th step, and it's not my job, but just to share a little bit about the shore of faith, I started going to meetings there, and no big book, no steps. You can imagine the share that was going on there. They were talking about their pains and joys. You know, if you don't have a sponsor and something happened, you cannot wait to get to the meeting and next week and tell them all about it. And on and on and on. And like this guy, his pain was he needed a colonoscopy. He had stomach problem, and I wanted to give him a colonoscopy right there with my foot, you know. 5 minutes. Like, who cares? And so I started going to meetings with my big book. They don't know over there, you don't bring your big book on this. It's a big book study, you know. Bring my big book there. And I started 2 meetings in our home. And then I offered them to do the steps. And this had never happened to them. This young guy, 14 years on the program, 3 months of sobriety, and he just couldn't make it. And I said, I'll do the steps with you. He said, what? I said, yes, I'll do the steps with you. But she said, nobody's ever offered that to me. But I said, you cannot do the steps alone. It's too hard. That's why nobody does them here, because nobody who has done them is sharing the information. If you're new, that's what I'm talking about. Alone, we don't get very far. They started reading the big book, and then they put it aside because it was just too hard. It's really one talking to another, sharing our experience. And so I said, all right. And you know, I had spoken at a meeting in the States a year before, and my hostess had this workshop, 40-page document. And I asked her if I could have one, so I translated it in French just in case. And there was my opportunity. I said, we'll do a step workshop. Come over Tuesday night, 6 o'clock, 2 hours each time, 12 to 15 times, we'll do your step. And then he was halfway through, and he said, you know, Lorenz, he would love to have my spot. Then I got a text from Bruno. Bruno said, Lynn, you're the one to do my step with. So I had 4 or 5 sometimes a week coming over. And my darling husband, I don't know what the neighbors thought. You know, first there was this... there is this one husband, and, you know, opening the gate so the man could come in. And then that husband moves out one morning, and the other one moves in the afternoon, you know. And these men, and it's his turn to open the gate. And those men, when they leave, they always look happier than when they came. You know? And so, that's what happened. And they even took a group conscience at one of their meetings so it would be allowed to talk about the steps in the big book. One old-timer said, all this talk about the steps is a threat to my sobriety. So those of you who are here right now having a convention like this, surrounded by heroes in Alcoholics Anonymous, and by that I mean doing it every day for 5 months, 5 years, 20 years, 40 years, still, to me, that's a hero. You're surrounded by women who have done that work, who can share it with you. It's not like this everywhere, but I could see with my eyes the results of no big book and no steps. And it's mean. It's very, very mean. And so here we learn truly to practice love and tolerance for our fellows. And my sponsees, they started their own step workshop in January back there. And 16 people registered, including old-timers. Towards the shores of faith. And it takes some tenacity, because some days it's very difficult to just do it one more day. Whether it's the loss of a job, the loss of a loved one, or sometimes it's just very exciting. I remember when I first had my first or second meeting with Werner, these were business meetings, He said, when was the last time you went to Africa? I said, we have to go. He said, we. Oh my goodness, I've never been on a business trip. This is in Africa. It could be overnight. I mean, how can I hide my feelings? How can I possibly? I mean, just like a teenager, right? And then I talked to a colleague, and she said, well, when we go on business meeting with men, we just take separate seats. So I said, oh, but then I'd be disappointed because I'd really want to be next to him. And that went on and on, you know. The shores of faith, well, to Africa, what am I going to do with this? There isn't a book specifically written about that either. And so I get an email from him with the reserved seats, right? I said, oh my gosh, is it going to be together or not? And then I read the email, it's not together. I said, oh no, he notices my feelings and he's letting me know that he's not interested. He's putting me back in my place. And that's just the way this is going to be. And I'm just so utterly disappointed. I said, well, I'll check again. Oh no, it's together. Oh no, I want to put my head on his shoulder. What if I won't? How am I going to? Oh no. Please relieve me of my thinking and return me to sanity. You know, either way, I think a lot. I overthink. And I'm not always aware of my thinking. I so need to be current. At least you can put the lid on when necessary, you know. If you are new, I pray that you will seek what we have, that you will take the action. Some will not, could not. My 28-year-old cousin could not, would not. And 4 or 5 weeks ago, he stole a car in the middle of the night, got chased by the police, crashed, and was a vegetable. And about a week and a half ago, they unplugged the machine and he passed away. This is alcoholism, nothing more, just alcoholism. And so if you are new, you stay with us. And our big book is very loud and very clear. This is a program that works under any circumstances whatsoever. I've shared with you about the first and the second. I can't wait now to hear about the third through the 12th step. To be here with you this weekend, and I thank you so much for listening to me tonight. Thank you.